Oh, yes. That's jazz violinist Regina Carter with Listen Here, except she's calling it, basically, Something for Grace. Grace happens to be her mother. And in 1997, when she put together this version, that was the intention to honor her mother and, of course, the originator of this particular tune. We had Eddie Harris. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And we return to our discussion, which was, we were overwhelmed with calls and with participation. That's a good thing. But we do have a particular amount of time, and we just could not make it. We could not accommodate everybody in our time slot. So I did announce that we will continue the discussion, and those of you who have yet to make plain your point of view on this trial that everybody's focusing on now, that is the trial of three men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery. And it's fraught already with a lot of problems, this trial. We'll see how they impact on the trial itself. But it's important to get your sense of where things are going, because we will see as it goes along whether you're right on the spot or whether you're a little off. But I believe more than likely you hit the spot in your analysis. 888-874-4888. So what are we talking about today? As the trial gets off the ground, we noted that they had a very rough time, and they still are having a very rough time, seating the jury. We don't know exactly the cause of it, although people may be quite accurate in surmising what is happening that is preventing a jury from being quickly seated and this trial getting underway. So that has been the first big problem, just getting a jury to start this trial properly. Now, as you may recall, this trial concerns a killing. It concerns a killing. And the killing was of a 25-year-old young man who left his home and, as he was leaving, told his mother that he was going to go for a little jog. He was in the habit of jogging. It helped him kind of release tensions, but it also helped him keep in shape. So I suppose while she was preparing dinner and whatever else, he figured that was a good time to go for a jog. And so he embarked on this jog. The community is a very interesting community. It's one of those communities that is newly, when I say newly, I don't mean just yesterday, but recently formed. You know, the expansion of cities and so forth, people are looking for places to live, and a style of living that is confluent with the way they want to live with their families. It's a residential community and not known for having any kind of disorder or trouble. And so he went on this jog. And before long, found himself being followed by a couple of trucks with people in them, of course. And the more he tried to get away from that, the more he found himself being encroached upon. And it was no doubt that these people in these trucks, whom he did not know, were after him. And they made that very, very plain when he reached a particular point in the Strug where there was, he couldn't figure out where else to go to evade them. This wasn't his community, but it was adjoining his community. And he decided to jog through it. By the way, he was an athlete in college, and he was accustomed to doing athletic things. So jogging was not an unusual pursuit for him. As he was cornered by these two trucks, one contained a father and son team. They were all white men. The father and son were together in one truck. And then there was another truck with a neighbor in it. The father-son team directly confronted him, accusing him essentially that he was up to no good. What was he doing there in that neighborhood, their neighborhood? And he can sense the escalation in hostilities and was attempting to just get away. But they were armed. The son of the father and son team was armed with a shotgun and pointed it at him, which meant he meant business. He was more than likely going to use it. And that is when Ahmad Aubrey knew that this was not going to turn out well. So he, at that point, was fighting for his life. He was trying to just escape. A kind of pull and tug and tussle began as Aubrey tried to wrestle the gun away from the son, but instead the son let three shots off, killing him, killing Aubrey immediately, instantly. And that's how this whole saga began. It is not unusual in certain parts of the South that people do not want to let go of the past. And they psychologically are tied to it in a very visceral way. In this neighborhood, it's just a neighborhood. I mean, nice houses and nice families, one supposes, living in those nice houses. Aubrey was living in a nice house too. But the psychological baggage that many people are walking around with and carrying, and it comes with a deep-seated anger and resentment, because that box opens up a box that some people are terrified of opening because it only leads one way, and that is great harm is going to be done. People begin to regress into the history of themselves, of their people, of their communities. And that's, in a sense, what happened here. These three men did not see Ahmaud Arbery as just a regular guy jogging. He was black. Why do blacks jog unless they're running away from something? He must have done something wrong. And he couldn't possibly be from a neighborhood with such nice houses and nice people. So he was immediately cast in the minds of these men as a suspect, although they didn't know of what. But in any event, they naturally, this, when I say naturally, I don't mean it in a good sense, they automatically is what I'm meaning. They automatically assumed authority over him. And that included the authority to take his life, which they did. So that's what the trial is about. Where we are now is in the stage of empaneling this jury, and we've learned that despite close to 1,000 notifications sent out to area people, which is what is typically done, they couldn't really get a jury yet, either because people refused to respond or they intended never to participate in any event. But that is the problem. That was a major problem, still is, and they're working it out. But how does that affect so-called justice? How is it that the wheels of justice don't turn as they predictably do when the races are different? Or circumstances are different for the people involved? Okay, so we started talking about that, and we will continue to discuss, even now, what this portends for this case. This blatantly, unapologetically racist attitude, this environment in which this case is supposed to occur with assurance of even-handed justice, how do you guarantee justice in an environment like that and with a history like that? Just so we mention, the father and son, there's a father and son team, and the father used to work in the prosecutor's office. That could be a problem. The son believes, well, like father, like son, I get to enjoy some of the rights and privileges my father enjoyed, including possibly killing somebody with impunity. And the other man involved is a neighbor. He was the one who filmed the whole transaction. And he's now having thoughts, because he might have thought in the beginning that this would be salacious. This would be a hot seller in particular communities that like to see the murders of black people and brown people so as to maintain their racial superiority. So in that sense, he probably expected this filming that he was doing to trigger a great deal of interest. It works the other way, though. He was able to capture exactly what the brutality of the moment was and how these men proceeded without a care in the world about what would happen to them, but that they were operating under the implicit understanding that is very old in certain parts of this country, that this is not a crime. And they will never, ever be held responsible for murder. They were maintaining order in their community. All right. The number to call is 888-874-4888. Let's see who's up and what you have to say. And this is, you're providing, I just want you to know what this exercise is, you're providing your own analysis of some of the, what you see as the major factors in this case so far, that more than likely will affect the outcome of this case. What do you see? What do you see as some of the factors that would greatly affect or could greatly affect the outcome of this case? 888-874-4888. Okay, nobody's up yet, so you're kind of slow today. You had a good weekend, and you still think it's the weekend? No, this is what we're supposed to do, because I want to break this idea that we wait for the news people to tell us what's happening. We wait for the newspapers and the television stations to instruct us as to what is happening. When we have our own brains, we can think, we can see things. We've been reading. We have a knowledge of the South. We have an idea of the social and political and economic factors that came into play on that day that cost this young man his life. And if handled right, and I'm using this in quotes here, if handled right, will basically vindicate the outrageous acts of these three white men in killing this young black man. All right, 888-874-4888. I feel like I'm pushing you. When, in fact, on Friday, we had more calls than we could possibly handle. What happened? Did some people get to you over the weekend and encouraged you to take it easy? Don't come to conclusions yet. You can come to conclusions. You have a brain, and you have knowledge in that brain, one hopes. And so you can make sense of a situation as it unfolds because you have context. You have a history, a familiar history in that part of the world. The way people think. You saw, more than likely, they saw the videotape of the actual killing. Three shots from a shotgun fired into the chest of a young man. And he falls, and he is dead by the time he falls. So this is very serious business. And this is not an ordinary trial, is it? This is a trial that once again confronts America about its racist past, a past in which so many people today are immersed and claim that as their legitimate history. And anything else is not history at all. Anything else is favoritism to people of color. We have to look at these things very carefully and see the message being sent. Listen to the message being sent. Look how well choreographed that is. So that even before the trial starts, people are automatically convinced that there will be no conviction. So we get a sense, once the trial does start, if it ever gets to starting, what is the narrative now that they will develop? It's on tape. We're seeing it. What is the narrative that would say it's Aubrey's fault that he was killed? And in a scenario like this, they all are citizens, one assumes. You know, we are ready to believe that the past is behind us. It isn't. How do we arrive at these conclusions? And how do we try to choreograph our actions to suit a narrative that simply does not hold up? 888-874-4888. I'll be moving on if we get no calls, because this is airtime and it's important. And I thought that people were based on the response on Friday was so overwhelming. Somebody got to you? Or did you get to yourself? And you said, I don't want any part of this. I don't want to be public about my feelings. I don't want to discuss my feelings at all. That's I can understand people feeling that way. I'm saying, let's talk about it. Because it's a trial. We have some appreciation for the major points of this trial. And what is our attitude? How are we feeling about this trial? What does it inform us about? Does it make you feel safe that we are in good hands in this nation? The court is doing its job. The jury will do its job. And justice will prevail. Are you sure about that? What so far has convinced you that justice will prevail? Explain it. We need to hear it, and we need to understand that point of view. Do you have any historical perspective here on this case? Yes, it's about a black man, a 25-year-old black man, shot and killed by a group of three white men. What could possibly have been their motive? What argument could they possibly put forward that would make sense as a defense here? What do you expect? Tark from Georgia, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's a pleasure to be on the show. I'm a longtime listener.
Thank you. I'm glad.
I think that the argument would be, though it's not necessarily a good one, but it's a often used one, that they were concerned about someone suspicious in the neighborhood. They followed him, and they had the right to bear arms, and for their own protection. And then when he assaulted them, I'm saying assault in air quotes, they would say they were assaulted and defended themselves, and which resulted in the loss of his life, similar to the excuse that many police officers use who are out of, misbehaving.
Does that make sense to you?
It doesn't make sense to me, but I'm very familiar with the argument, and I think that it gives enough credibility to people who want to believe it to say that that's what it was. But I don't believe the argument at all.
Well, let's take a look at what you said, that they were armed. And the inference that I got from what you said was that they were protecting the neighborhood.
Yes.
From this intrusion.
Yes.
What would have been the intrusion as they defined it? Where did their argument fall apart on that score?
I guess it falls apart in many parts. The fact that they don't know that he's an outsider. The fact that they don't know that he was up to any nefarious, intents or activities. I think it falls apart right there. But I think when people say they're afraid of something, oftentimes that's a nod and a wink to other people who understand the code that this is a dangerous person inherently because he's a black male who's large and athletic. And I believe he also stopped at, at some point he stopped at some house that was under construction and examined it,
yes. Like,
looked at it. And in my experience, I'm from Boston, and in my experience, nothing more is needed than that for a white person who has been entitled throughout life in various ways and taught to understand that there's certain permissions granted to take liberties with the life and space of black people in particular.
Okay. All right. What will you be looking for specifically in this trial?
I think what will be interesting is who, if the person making the video is given a deal, and also what evidence is excluded. Because usually I think that's what some of the most interesting things are what's excluded from a trial so that they can't even be considered by the jury that's, selected.
Okay. Well, thank you for getting us started. Thank you for calling in. Pat from Brooklyn, you're on the air. At 888-874-4888.
Good afternoon. How are you, Ms. Lee?
I'm okay. It's Utrice. Pat.
Okay, Ms. Utrice Lee. How are you? How's everything?
No, I meant you could call me Utrice. Just plain Utrice. It's fine.
Okay.
All right.
This case seems like the old-fashioned historical coon hunting case. I say that not to be disrespectful to Mr. Aubrey, but in reality, it's like you said, you started the program talking about the past and historical references. So that's the reason why I made that comment. But I'm just curious. Did the father's son go in the house and retrieve that shotgun? Or do they just normally drive around with the shotgun in the car? That's
one
thing I
got. That's a good question.
Secondly,
excellent question.
You got to start somewhere. In reference to the Zimmerman case where he had a licensed handgun and people do carry their handguns, okay. Are these people community street watching to see if, we're just, making sure that the neighborhood is safe? I'm not sure if that's the case. Did they see this young man drive through that community before? Is this the first time they seen him, or are they watching to see him again? These are things, but I don't know. And the other thing is, dead man don't tell any tales. So you have three individuals who's living; they have time to collaborate their stories. Yet the deceased there's no conversation on his part. Once again, making reference to the Zimmerman case. Where Zimmerman family had relationships to the criminal justice system. I believe it was the prosecutor's office at the time. So does this individual. He also has a relationship with the prosecutorial office. I'm not sure if the Aubrey family is going to get justice. Historically, you fall short on those things when the person is actually deceased as opposed to injured. I don't see a lot coming out of it. I'll wait and see. But I won't be disappointed if the injustice system does what the injustice system does to black and brown people in reference to these historical cases.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Pat, for your offering today. It should be considered and put it in the pot so that people don't forget what you just said as having relevance in this case. Thank you. Leona from Michigan, you're on the air.
Greetings, Shutrice, and greetings to your audience.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Listen, that 25-year-old black man wasn't guilty of anything except being a 25-year-old black man. And he was defined as a black man by this system of racism, white supremacy. Now, my question, here's the deal. You know, with the George Floyd case, you know, they convicted that white man. And I'm wondering if this is a thing where the system just cannot have another conviction of white people, of, white males exercising their white supremacist power to just indiscriminately, just kill black people at will. You know, I'm wondering, the fact that they cannot get a jury seated, I'm wondering if it's a thing where, if there's a connection, the system just cannot tolerate another conviction because they already convicted Derek Chauvin, who may well be, he's appealing, I think. In fact, appealing that conviction. I don't know. What do you think? Any connection?
I don't think so. I mean, not in the strict sense that this case and that case are similar. But it may just be, it could be the case that people are seeing this as a reaction of a heightened sense of superiority, and they will not allow themselves to be done in by anybody black doing, living and doing their own thing. Don't forget that there is a connection with the local prosecutor's office here through the father. The son thinks like the father. So they may be, in their heads, perfectly fine in acting like semi-prosecutors or semi-police officers themselves. Keeping the community safe, but from what? What would attract their attention to this black man? What was it that started the suspicion that he was up to no good? Was it that he was black and he was in a neighborhood just like the neighborhood he lived in? Not far away when he was jogging? Did they know him? Did they have to? Or did they come to this moment in time absolutely sure that they were stand-ins for white supremacy? We own this place. You don't get to just jog through here. You are here because you're thinking of doing something illegal, and we are here to prevent it from happening.
Yes, but yeah, but that's the mindset. I think pretty good arguments can be made. That's the mindset that operates on a global level. you know, the system of white supremacy, which is global. I would argue.
Yes, but it's very local too. It's very local.
It's global, local, national. Yes, this is the government we live under. We do not live under democracy. We live under the world government of white supremacy, the system of white supremacy. But I'm wondering. More will be revealed. More will be revealed. The same thing that those white guys feared, I suspect, I don't know, but it's the same thing that used to make their relatives or other white folks in this country cut off black men's penises and testicles and, you know, pickle them and sell them and the whole nine yards. It's the same motivation, I think, It really needs to stop. God knows it does. Good Lord. I think Bobby Wright wrote a book called, what, The Psychopathic Personality of a Racist or something. I'm misquoting the name of his book. But I think I'm going to be quiet right now. I was just wondering if you thought there might be a connection with, the fact that they convicted one white guy, you know, a few months ago. And
he was a cop.
Yeah. Yeah, well, these three cats acted like, quote-unquote, cops, too, to a degree, I guess. But back in the day, or even now, all white folks were deputized to police black folks. All of them are deputized.
Well, the argument could be made that the father, that's a guy who took the initiative and the others went along with it, having been affiliated with the prosecutor's office, was in fact a lawman for all intents and purposes. So he was operating on good instinct.
Good instinct.
Yeah.
I don't get it. What do you mean operating on good instinct? What
do
you mean?
Yes, because he could spot a criminal from 10 miles away.
Oh, yeah.
He knows how criminals act. He knows what they tend to look like.
Yes, I see. He hasn't looked in the mirror lately, evidently, I guess. What have you.
All right,
yeah,
Viola,
but you know, I appreciate
Viola,
you bringing
you
up
so much.
This subject because, you know, discussing racism, discussing white supremacy, it's a difficult subject. And back in 2014, when Dr. Francis Kress Welsing was in Michigan speaking at the Charles H. Wright Museum, one of the things she said was that the denial of racism, white supremacy, is one of the major detriments to mental health. It stops mental health, the denial of the existence of racism, white supremacy.
But how
major...
do you translate that into this trial?
I beg your
how
pardon? What?
Do you introduce that concept in this trial?
How do you introduce that concept into this trial?
Yes.
The concept that the denial of racism, white supremacy, is a major blockage to mental health?
No, I'm saying you have to offer a defense, even to the people you believe don't deserve one. What would you offer for public consideration in behalf of these men accused?
Okay, just hypothetically, whatever. I'll just say, well, look, we saw a black man, and we saw that automatically triggered our fear of white genetic annihilation. Just seeing a black man, it just automatically triggered our fear of white genetic annihilation because we know a black man could annihilate us genetically. A black woman can't.
But you know, the average white person isn't walking around with these thoughts. In the
maybe
scenario that we're talking about now, they saw a young black man jogging. And immediately they went into not just defensive mode, but into attack mode. What was that about? They don't know what you're talking about. They have no idea about white supremacy. They're doing what's
they do. Yes, they do. If that was a 25-year-old white guy jogging, they might not. They probably wouldn't have messed with him. They probably wouldn't have chased him down with their rifles and in the gun, you know, and in their truck. They know about it.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in and contributing today. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. We are winding down for the day. Our time is slipping by. So if you have something to contribute, now would be the time. Don't wait. You might miss the opportunity. 888-874-4888. What could possibly be the defense here for the killers, the three killers of Ahmaud Arbery? And how could they make it palatable and believable to the general public? Because this is the whole point. Their actions, of course, we know these were individual actions, but they will say that because of their experiences, they were basically protecting the safety and interests of a community against possible invasion and possible crime. Is that a good argument? How will that play out in a courtroom and at this time? Would people believe that there is some merit to that argument? Henry from Georgia, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice. It's a pleasure to talk to you this afternoon.
Thank you. You too.
I live in Georgia, and I used to live in New Jersey, so I've been following you since you were on NJN. So I remember one day I was crossing the road just to get my mail, and a sheriff's car drove by. And I live in rural Georgia, and a sheriff's car drove by, and he slowed down. And I thought to myself, this is my last day. So I got my mail, and I turned around, and I walked, and I came back into the house. And he continued driving. I guess he thought better. But this case has always really, when I first saw it, it really got to me. But I think there's a chance of a conviction. The district attorney in this particular case that allowed these three individuals to walk because of an old racist law of civil arrest, that you can arrest somebody, a civilian can arrest someone for committing a crime. Well, that's from the 1800s. That has been scrapped recently. The district attorney that allowed them to do that, she has been let go. She's being prosecuted because there have been other similar cases in that area. They're having problems because I think people just don't want to, especially in that community, it's a small community. Some people are kind of maybe fearful, possibly, you know. But I just hope that they don't change the venue because of that. Any little excuse. Another thing is that they are presently in jail, which I'm surprised at. They've been in jail for quite some time. Well, not quite some time, but a few months. So it goes back to that issue that we talked about a little earlier. We're stamped from the beginning. I do not walk or jog unless it's in a designated area. Every morning I go to a park where there's a walk around this little lake, and that's where I walk. That's where most black people in our neighborhood jog or walk. Nobody walks on the road or jogs on the road. It's just, you know, something that you just don't do. You know what I mean? As a black person. So that's basically what I had this morning, this afternoon.
Okay, are you saying then that in part we have to consider that maybe Ahmaud Arbery was probably not thinking that jogging could cost him his life where he intended to jog?
Well, it's like a few years ago, if you do remember the Indian man that went out for a walk and he was accosted by a police officer, and I think he's still, he might even be a paraplegic to this day. Ahmaud Arbery had every right, as we know, to go out jogging, and he's been doing it for quite a while. But a black man running, not jogging in their minds, in our minds he was jogging, in their minds he was running. What was he running away from? Not that he had, you know, shorts on and a white T-shirt like a jogger would. He wasn't looked at as a jogger. He was looking at a young black man running down the street. From what? So, in their eyes, you know, these little people are very suspicious of things. I have walked in the park that I walk in with people that have their hands on their guns as they're walking past me.
Oh, wow.
And I walk with another black man. So he did the right thing. I don't see anything wrong with him, whether he was walking or jogging. He has every right to.
What then do you say about the mentality that produced this reaction of shooting him dead?
It
despite
is
the fact they had no interchange, at least we do not understand that they had some kind of traded words or anything like that. He was just jogging.
He was just
and
jogging.
They independently
they
came to the conclusion
him.
That he had to be stopped.
Right. They stopped him. They stopped him. They got out of the truck. What was the reason for them doing that? I mean, the defense has to answer that question. What was the reason for them doing that? There's no justifiable reason, you know, for them to stop him as he's running down the street. He had nothing in his hand. You know, but this is the way that they think down here. You know, that it's a very I thought New Jersey was bad. And then on the other hand, you know, you've got people down here that really would probably vote for not guilty. White people.
Why would they vote not guilty?
Because they know, they've seen it so many. It's like the lady, the white lady that was pulled over in Georgia a year or two ago, and she had her hands on the steering wheel. And the white officer came up to her and said, "What you got your hands on your steering wheel for?" She says, "Well, I know how you guys are. You overreact." She says, "No, we don't. We kill black people. We don't kill white folks." He got fired for that. White officers get fired down here in Georgia. Getting them to go to jail is another thing, but they get fired. you know.
So where do you see this trial going? What would be the key points in this trial that have to be made and that have to persuade a jury one way or the other?
Well, there's no, what was the reason that you stopped him? What was the reason that, what was the reason that you followed him in the first place? What was the reason that you stopped him? Why did you bring out your rifle? They can't say that he attacked them. They got out of the truck with the rifle pointing towards him. They videotaped that themselves.
Do you think they would be successful in convincing a jury drawn of local people that they, as experienced as they were because of their connections with the local prosecutor's office, that they had reason to believe that they were right to suspect him of some wrongdoing? They just didn't know what, but they were taking, as they would call it, preemptive action.
Okay, let's say that they go in that route. Then why was he shot three times? Did you say three times in the chest, right? I think it was, right?
Yes.
Three times in the chest?
Yes.
You didn't shoot him. In other words, so you could have actually had a conversation with this person because he was facing you. You didn't shoot him in the back. He wasn't running away in the back. When you got out of the truck, he faced you. That's not a guilty person that faced you. You know, what's up? What's going on? I don't know how this is going to go, but there's a lot going for Mr. Aubrey.
We will see.
Yeah, we'll see. But
I don't know what the jury looks like.
Yeah, and there's another case, the Rittenhouse case. That one, he'll probably walk. But this one, I don't know.
Well, thank you for calling in and for contributing some very, some issues that deserve further exploration. But we'll see how it works out.
Thank you, Yatrice.
Thank
you very
much. I just want to ask you this last question. What about the attitudes that we're seeing as expressed by the locals, what does it portend for this trial?
Well, they all know each other. All the white people, all the black people, they all know each other. And, everybody's running away from having to admit the truth, probably. They know what happened. And, it's going to take a few people, hopefully, that they finally get to, that'll sit there and stand up and tell the truth. I think that's what they're going through right now. There are a lot of people that are probably connected one way or another. They work in the city, and they don't want to get involved in it. But there'll be one or two, three or four maybe, that'll just say, hey, look, this is what happened. I think that's what's eventually going to take place down there.
All right. Well, thank you for putting us on notice, and thank you for your analysis today. We'll see how it all works out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. We're talking about things in a way, in hypotheticals. But in another way, we have good backup historically for expressing the views that you heard today. Time has given us reason to feel that there's merit in the arguments that people are making, because they've seen things like this over and over again. And the one thing that they don't see very often is justice. So we'll see how this works, but we have to keep an eye on this case. And by that, I don't mean being silent and just watching. I mean being involved in some way or the other to export our feelings about this trial and things that we see that may not be going right. As I said before, the fact that people are reluctant to sit on a jury in this case says that there's a lot of trepidation. And from the outside, we can make all kinds of judgments about that. But living there is what you have to understand. There are rules that these people have had to face after many, many years of relative calm. Here comes a case that troubles the water. And they're in it. So we can't blame them. We have to understand what is going on. So thank you so much for contributing today. Let's meet up again tomorrow and talk some more. Bye-bye.